You're listening to the Play Therapy Podcast with Dr. Brenna Hicks, your source for centered and focused play therapy coaching.
Welcome to the Play Therapy Podcast. This is a unique scenario because we typically don't do video podcasts, but I'm so excited that today we are interviewing Dr. Jennifer Baggerly, who has such a special place in my heart. So I'll share a little bit more about that in the moment, but I'm so excited to have a chance to spend some time with her today. And I know that you will greatly benefit from this experience because I have benefited so much from her in my life. So Dr. Baggerly, thank you. Welcome. I'm so glad that you're here.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here with you.
Oh, I'm so excited. So if you don't mind, some of our listeners are very well aware of you because I talk about you a lot. But for those that may be new to the field or new to the podcast, if you could just kind of share a little bit about who you are and introduce yourself a little bit so they can get to know you.
Sure. Well, great. Thank you for having me again. So I'm Dr. Jennifer Baggerly, and I'm a professor of counseling and play therapy at the University of North Texas at Dallas. And I'm also a practicing licensed professional counselor and registered play therapist supervisor at Kaleidoscope Behavioral Health in Flower Mound, Texas. I also do some supervision and such online. And so I've been a play therapist and counselor for over 30 years. Right. I hate saying that because it really makes me feel old, but it's been an absolute joy to be in the field of play therapy that long. And I have a daughter, and Brenna was with me on my journey as I adopted my daughter from Kazakhstan, international adoption. And she saw her when she was little itty bitty. And now she's 18 years old and she's thriving and just doing great and interested in creating and producing children's cartoons. So, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, and
oh, it sure doesn't.
Working with children.
So that's so awesome. Yeah. So really quick story about Caitlin. You brought her to several of the classes, and I remember you had to change her diaper on the floor of the lab. So
yes.
I vividly remember those early days.
Yes, indeed. She grew up with play therapy. I would take her to so many of my classes when she was little, as you remember, and she and her friends would be the subjects for play therapy, and she just has grown through it. And as a matter of fact, I've even recently had her kind of do some role play with my current students. And so when the students are a little off on their response, she'll look at them and just sort of like, "You're not supposed to say it that way." if they ask a question, she looks at them, and then sometimes she'll even correct it, you know, just out of innocence. But she is so ingrained in her because she's grown up with child-centered play therapy.
Yes. And actually, I have two related points to that. So I remember shortly after you adopted her, I remember you saying, "Brenna, when you have kids of your own, just know that it's okay to throw everything you know about play therapy out the window." Yes. So I remember you saying that to me. That has always stuck.
Yes.
And then also, it's funny that you mentioned she's been around it her whole life, because so has my son. Yes. And he's almost 14. And I tell therapists and clinicians and my trainees all the time that he has only ever known play therapy, because I've used it as my parenting approach. I've used it as the way that I interact with him. And so he knows it just like your daughter does. And so sometimes, you know, he'll joke and he'll be like, "Can you not be Miss Brenna right now?" What he thinks of me as like my therapist person.
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, when they're surrounded by it, they just learn it, and it, you know, it becomes something that they understand very importantly. So yeah, so special.
Yes.
All right. So thanks so much for giving us a little bit more information about yourself. And then if you wouldn't mind, share with us how you became a play therapist. What was your play therapy journey?
Yes, I'd love to do that, because I probably had a journey maybe similar to many of your listeners. I had completed my master's degree in counseling in Colorado, and my particular program really just focused on adults. They just barely touched on adolescence, and their philosophy was, you know, when it comes to children, just work with the parents. And so that was it. Well, when I went to get my first job as a counselor, they told me, oh, your first client is a child. And I'm like, what? Okay. And they said, and here's a playroom. And I had absolutely never even heard of the word play therapy before, literally never heard of it. So I just kind of panicked and started reading a bunch of play therapy books, getting some ideas of things. And then I would scramble and go to some trainings, you know, one training here, another training there. And it was all confusing. And I have this vivid memory of working with this little 7-year-old girl. And so I would go to one training and they would say, well, you know, do this directive technique. And so, oh, okay, all right, that's what I'm supposed to do. So I'd go in, you know, kind of nurse and start this some technique that they would show me in the play therapy training that was not child-centered play therapy. I didn't even know there was child-centered play therapy at that point. And the kid would just look at me and say, why do you keep changing what we're doing every time?
Wow.
It's like that was out of the mouth of babes, because right. She just wanted to play. And and she was really doing the work at the time of just play therapy. She had been a child who had been sexually abused, and she would go and put on the police outfit, and she would say, what did you do? And then she would look at me and she would say, did you have sex? And I was like shocked. I didn't know what I was supposed to say. And, but it dawned on me, that was exactly how her mother was coming, across to her, because, her mom was pretty harsh at the time. And, so this child was just playing it out. And I was just so confused about, now, what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to do that? Or am I supposed to teach her something? And then finally, thank goodness, Gary Landreth did a training in Colorado at that time. And this was way back in the 1990s, mid 1990s. He did a 2-day child-centered play therapy training. And I went there and I was like, oh, yes, this is what aligns with my own perspective of children. This is how I would naturally do it, except for I've been to all these other trainings and they're saying, no, do this, no, do this. Do. And I was getting confused. And so I was like so relieved. And so I just read his book. And then I said, you know what, I really wanted to get more training. And the only way at that time was for me to basically sell my nice condo in Colorado and give up my hiking lifestyle and everything and my job and move and get my PhD at the University of North Texas. And so that's what I did, just so that I could get that type of training. Fortunately, now we have these options too, where people don't have to make such a huge sacrifice. But it was a real pleasure. In 1996, I went and got my doctorate degree at University of North Texas and trained under Gary Landreth. I was one of the assistants, assistant manager at the Center for Play Therapy. And so I just went through there and got my PhD, got a lot of great training, wonderful exposure for the really international specialists they would bring in play therapy, like Ileana Gill and others like that. And Clark Moustakas, I had the pleasure of meeting. And so then my first job was at the University of South Florida in Tampa. And that's where I met you. And and at that time, they had absolutely no play therapy training. And I was just absolutely determined to make it happen. So I started that play therapy certificate program where I taught the intro to play therapy, the group play therapy, and the filial therapy all in sequentially that you went through. And then I was there about 11 years, and then I moved back to the Fort Worth, Dallas area so that I could be with my mother. And I've been at the University of North Texas at Dallas, which is different than UNT Denton. University of North Texas at Dallas, and I've been training and teaching play therapy there, and just have had a great time. Really, it's very exciting to me because we have really increased the number of African-American play therapists and Latinx play therapists because of the population in our area. And so we're doing some great work there. So I'm really happy about that. So that was really my play therapy journey. And now I'm also a practicing play therapist in the town where I live. And so I live and eat and breathe it every day.
Me too. And yes. And I always, you know, I've talked about this on the podcast in earlier episodes, but I always have felt that I was just at the right place at the right time because you had a pretty short stint in Florida actually. And for your career anyway. And, you know, I remember, and I shared this in like my earliest episodes, but you would be lecturing a class that had nothing to do with kids. And you would just randomly say, and, you know, then when I work with kids in play therapy, and then you'd move on. And I just remember it was the same thing where you said you'd never heard of play therapy, nor had I. And it was one of those things where I just kept in the back of my head, like, what is she talking about? What is this play therapy thing? And so it was the same discovery process for me. And, you know, obviously the graduate certificate program that you started and I was able to participate in, that moment where you said it clicked with you and you said, this is how I would naturally interact. Every drive home from that class, and it was an hour from USF to home, I would call my husband and just, oh my gosh. And then we learned this. And then you're supposed to do this and you're supposed to reflect feelings and you're supposed to use encouragement. And it was like, you don't know what you don't know, but when you find what you've always needed, you just can't believe that it wasn't in your awareness before that moment.
Right.
So, yeah. I went through the same thing as a result of you being at USF. So I am very grateful that you were here for a short little bit of time.
Yes.
Yeah. So knowing how important it is to both of us, and I mean, I'm just grateful that you were part of my journey as my mentor for all these years, but help us understand what in your experience do you think is maybe the one or two or however many reasons you think really stand out for you? Why does child-centered play therapy work? What experientially have you kind of formed as your reasoning for how it's so effective?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say child-centered play therapy is respectful to children because it honors their developmental needs to play. And young children, and I even work with two-year-olds through elementary school, preschool, elementary school, they want to play. Mm-hmm. So child-centered play therapy respects that developmental need. And I think that a lot of children, they want to tell their story, but through play, and sometimes adults have kind of maybe conditioned them to say this or that or believe this or that. But if given the opportunity in that safe environment with the well-stocked playroom that's carefully selected toys, then the child will have the opportunity to play that out. And, you know, I just remember working with children in the past, allowing them to address their needs. So as I mentioned before, that little girl, the first one that I worked with, who was 7 years old, had been brought in for sexual abuse. I remember one session she came in and I finally got the idea, just let, you know, her play and provide the child-centered play therapy, therapeutic responses. So this child was playing and she's playing in the dollhouse and she took five of the dolls and put them in one little room. And then she had one of the adult dolls walking around saying, "Be quiet, you're too loud, be quiet, behave." And I'm like thinking, okay, you know, this doesn't sound like this has much to do with sexual abuse. And I just have this sense of something else is going on. I don't know what is going on. But so she was doing that. And then later the mom told me in that after the session, she said, "Oh yeah, well, we were just recently evicted from our apartment and we had to move in with a family from church." And I'm like, oh, that's what this child was playing out, that she is now in this other person's house and the five of them and their family are stuck in this one room. And she's constantly hearing probably either from mom or maybe the family they live with, you know, be quiet, don't do that, you know. And so she was playing that out. And if I had taken a more directive approach of saying, okay, we're going to address your sexual abuse, then I would have missed what was on her mind. And her mind at that time is this huge adjustment we've had to make because now we are virtually homeless. So to me, that's just that example of letting the child lead the play where they need to, respecting and honoring that. And then, you know, in contrast to my early days, again, working with children, I remember one of these techniques I had learned is using some yarn on your fingers and doing some of these cat's cradle type things going back and forth, and then trying to use it as a metaphor with children. And so I remember I used it as a metaphor with this 10-year-old girl who was going through a divorce. Her parents were going through a divorce, and she was really smart. And I'm like, oh, you know, here's this string, and sometimes it gets all tangled up. Does this remind you of anything in your life? And so this smart 10-year-old goes, yeah, it kind of reminds me of my parents. They're getting a divorce, and now life is just all knotted up, and I can't figure it out. And I was like, oh, yay. I figured it out, how to get kids to talk about divorce. And so then I used it with another little girl who was like 6 years old, who was also going through divorce. And so I was doing the same thing. And does this yarn getting all knotted up, does it remind you of anything? And she looks at me and she goes, well, yeah, sometimes my shoestrings get tied in a knot. And I'm like, okay, that metaphor went right over a 6-year-old's head. They're not going to understand that. So that's that idea of, you know, just allowing the child to play and take that where they need to. I'm always amazed of how that happens as we in child-centered play therapy allow the child to work out their own difficulties, trusting their self-actualizing potential to go where they need to. So recently I had a little girl who came in and she was having some difficulties with sleeping on her own. She was just some nervous about a few things. And so she was going in and kind of crashing in her parents' rooms or they would sometimes say, well, go, you know, sleep with your sister. She was having this struggle, nervousness. So she came in the playroom and I had the sand tray out with all of our little sand tray figurines as well. And so she took this lion and put it in the sand tray and she's walking around with a lion and the lion was going, I need a bed. I need a bed. So I'm just reflecting, oh, the lion's really angry. It needs a bed, a safe place to be. So then she finds these little kind of shiny rock type things and lays them out and creates a bed for him. The lion lays down. And then she goes to the sand tray. We have all these sand trays, just a ton of different animals and things. And she finds a little lamb. And the lamb comes into the sand and is going, I need a place to sleep. I need a place to sleep. And so then she finds a shell for the lamb to lay in. Then she finally finds this little bug, you know, like it was a bug with little legs sticking out. The bug's going around going, I need a place to sleep. I need a place to sleep. Goes over to the lion and is like, can I sleep with you? And the lion's like, aha, quit waking me up. And then the bug goes over to the little, to the lamb. It's like, I need a place to sleep. And the lamb's like, no, go away, go away. And so then finally this little girl gets like two shells and covers the little bug in the shell. And it's like, I'm trying to find a place to sleep. And I'm reflecting that bug really is doing everything it knows how to find a safe place where it feels comfortable to sleep. And, you know, and the lion's like, you're fine there. You're fine. You're going to be okay. And then finally the bug kind of settles in and has a good night's sleep. And so, you know, this little girl was really playing out her experience of not being able to sleep and getting to the point of mastery so that she could find that settled place where she felt safe. And I'm, you know, reflecting the feelings of she's confused. She doesn't know where to go, or it's confused. It doesn't know where to go. So I'm reflecting feelings. I'm trying to facilitate understanding. It just wants a good night's sleep and it needs a safe place. It needs to be understood. And through that process, she was able to kind of resolve this difficulty she was having with sleeping. And you know, and it got better. She was able to sleep more on her own. And so that's part of why I really believe play therapy is so helpful with children, is that they can work out their own problems. If we give them that unconditional positive regard, the genuineness, the congruence, you know, all of Axline's 8 basic principles, and create that safe space where they can work it out as we give the therapeutic responses.
Right. And I mean, I love those stories because I think they're just so helpful to illustrate what's going on in the playroom from a child-centered perspective. And, you know, it's interesting that you brought up sleeping and you brought up some of these other things, even with the eviction, because I can't tell you the number of times a child plays something out in my playroom, and then either that week or the next week, I have a meeting with the parent scheduled already. So it just falls in the same week span. Mm-hmm. And before they say a word to me, I say, I'm curious if there's anything going on with sleeping, or I'm curious if there's anything going on with bath time, or I'm curious if there's anything going on with teeth brushing. And they think I like have a magic eight ball or something. They're like, how in the world did you know that? And I'm like, because that's what the child played out this week. And mm-hmm. I mean, that is the beauty of the model, right? Where they came in for usually, I mean, I don't think most people reach out because there's a bath time struggle, right? So, I mean, that was not on the docket of things we have to address. But as the child is working through things, it inevitably becomes part of the process. And that is so amazing to me. I call it the magic of child-centered play therapy, right? Because all of a sudden now I have insight that there's something going on, or the child wouldn't have brought it into the play. And that is the beauty of the process, where the child says, I'm working on these big things, but sometimes I need to work on these little things. And sometimes, you know, like I'm in a room with 5 people and we're constantly being told to be quiet. I need to sort that out in my brain because it's new and it's different and it's confusing. And that's, I love it. Yeah. All right. So speaking of loving child-centered therapy, what do you see as your standouts for why you love this approach?
Well, you know, it's fun for kids. And it's really fun and fascinating for me as the therapist, because I'm witnessing this transformation as we're talking about, and in a way that it has not been scripted, but is much more natural. So that part, I love that part. It's fun for the kids. The kids are having fun, and sometimes they're just really working hard, but doing it in a way that is fun. I think that it also, I love it because as you mentioned, kind of seeing that magic happen, seeing the child resolve their own difficulties in a child-led way. So like, I remember a 3-year-old boy I worked with, his mom brought him in because he was about to get kicked out of his second preschool for being, quote, disobedient. Mm-hmm. And so the mom was very concerned about this, of course. And mom said, well, he's quote, disobedient because the teachers tell him to sit down in the chair and color this picture that they've asked him to color, and he doesn't do it. And so he'll get out of the chair and wander around. And then then they make him miss the outdoor playtime. So he'll finish the picture and then he doesn't do it. And then they put him in timeout. And so this little 3-year-old boy, he just, you know, he was not having it. And it reminds me of one of your podcasts about how kids cannot be manipulative, you know, and in this sense, for a 3-year-old, you kind of think, you know, how is it that a preschool teacher would expect a child to sit down for a whole hour and color when there are all these fun other toys beckoning them in within the room? So it was, you know, it was one of those things of, yeah, I'm not seeing this as a child being disobedient. It's that the school and the teacher has not yet figured out how to help meet his needs. So anyway, this boy, he comes in and he starts playing with the puppets and he gets this little dog puppet in, and he's like, the dog was wanting to chase the ball and do all this stuff. And then he got the witch puppet and the witch is flies and snatches the dog puppet and like throws him across the room and says, "You're in timeout." Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, oh, you know, this is pretty much his experience in preschool. And so I'm reflecting feelings that the dog is really scared. That witch is so angry. And the dog is so scared. He was just trying to play. He's confused too. Now he's away from his friends and some, you know, narrating all this and reflecting this. And within a couple of sessions, he got to the point, would replay this like several times. And so definitely was this theme of conflict, relational conflict and good versus bad and all this. And, you know, the witch, "You're a bad dog, you're a bad dog." And so finally, a couple sessions later, same thing, you know, the dog's chasing the ball, trying to play. The witch comes and tries to grab him. But this time the dog like bites at the witch and says, "I'm not bad, you're bad." And he throws the witch over into timeout.
Wow.
And so, you know, it was like he finally had this epiphany of, you know, that I'm not bad. I'm just, you know, a dog trying to have fun. I'm just a kid trying to have fun. Obviously, we don't want the child to bite his teacher and throw him in timeout. But that was just that sense of, you know, wait a minute. He was almost saying, no, I have a right to be respected here. I'm a kid. I have a right to be respected, to play. And so, you know, he started working that out. And the biggest thing there that was that I love about play therapy is that he shifted his self-esteem. He shifted the way that he was perceiving himself and others. And so instead of seeing himself as bad, he was seeing himself more as empowered and being able to stand up for himself. And so from there, you know, I was able to give mom some feedback and even offer to give the teacher some feedback so that the teacher could have a different understanding of his needs. And that, you know, really worked out well. But those are some of the reasons I love play therapy, is that the child is having fun and they're solving their own problems through the process.
And you actually bring up an interesting point that I think is worth spending a couple moments on, because I think when you are a child, when you're a play therapist, period, but specifically when you're a child-centered play therapist, I think we wear lots of hats. We talk mm-hmm. about that a lot in the podcast too. But I think one of the most important and significant platforms that we've been given is to give adults who love kids. So this is principals, teachers, guidance counselors, daycare workers, coaches, whatever adults that are pouring into these kids' lives, and then they become our clients. It's about giving them a different perspective, isn't it? Like, so yes. Much of the time I feel like I'm doing education and I'm doing explanation and I'm doing developmental understanding and I'm doing all of these things because, you know, this 3-year-old is not going to succeed in the current environment, right? And so it's not about saying he's bad or you're the witch and he's the dog. It's none of those things, right? It's like saying, but how do we make this successful for everyone? And I think so much of the time, it's a perspective shift. It's a different frame or different lens through which you view the behavior. Because if you see it as a little boy who just really wants to get up and be active and have fun, it's no longer disobedient. It's no longer defiant. It's no longer resistant. It's give him opportunities to do the things that he wants to do and help him find the balance. And why I think play therapy is so amazing, to speak to the things that you love about it, there's almost always a role reversal that takes place when a child is sorting out who they are and what they want to be, because self-actualization is, I know that I'm capable of being better, right? So when you have this child that role reverses and all of a sudden goes, no, you go to timeout, you're the bad one. You know, it's like they realize that there's good and bad in all things, and they find the balance, and balance is always healthy. And so, yeah, I love watching that process too. And you know, I think that that's one of the things that we have to really champion, is helping people understand a different perspective. Because when I meet with parents for consultations, I feel like so much of what I do is help them understand through a different framework why the child is behaving the way that they are. And then it doesn't necessarily make it easier, but because it's still frustrating or it's still difficult or it's still whatever, but at least with an understanding of why, you can then make appropriate decisions as a result of your understanding. And I think that's really powerful.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that really leads into a logical next step for many parents, and maybe even teachers, is the child-parent relationship therapy and or the child-teacher relationship therapy. And for many kids, you know, I'll see them and they'll make that progress and they'll have that shift. And then it becomes clear to me that a parent, and sometimes it's not the parent necessarily that brings them, but a spouse needs the child-parent relationship therapy. And I've done that before with some kids like this boy, and say, okay, you know what, let's have dad come in and we'll go through the child-parent relationship therapy. And because sometimes I know that, you know, their lives are very busy and they're basically not going to do the therapy at home, the practice therapy session, I'll have it in session. And so I'll just say, well, this time you bring your son, and then I can kind of be there and coach along the way in a live format. It's helpful, very helpful if it's recorded and then you can look back at it. But I found that some, it's just not going to happen that way. So I have to make some adaptations. And it's interesting seeing that process, because just the empowerment of children after they've been through child-centered play therapy and they get that sense of empowerment. I just remember this one boy playing. He was with dad in the playroom. He's at the puppet stage, and he's doing his thing with his little puppets and saying, I want to fight. And the dad, although he had been taught to reflect feelings and to try to track play behavior, this dad just could not help himself and said, well, those puppets shouldn't be fighting. They should be sharing. And this little boy, this 3-year-old boy, pokes out of the puppet stage and says, Daddy, stop it. Just listen.
And
I was like, wow. And I'm like, okay, I need not say anything more. And the dad got it, to his credit. Dad got it. He's like, okay. You know, and then we were able to, I was able to process with the dad, you know, remember that? And he's like, I know. I asked a question. I was trying to teach him to share because he fights with his little brother all the time. I know. And he told me, and I was so proud of that little boy. It's like, yeah, dad needed to hear that, you know, stop trying to teach me, understand that I'm frustrated that brother will not share the toys. Just understand me, dad, you know, and so it was just, you know, again, one of those powerful things of, and where the boy was able to ask for what he needed, and the dad recognizing, okay, my son is frustrated with me because I'm not giving him what he needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those are such precious moments. And I do CPRT at my center. I train CPRT and I think it's so valuable. I think it makes such a difference when you can clearly see the child has done as much work as the child is capable of doing. And I typically say that it's like a, you know, child starts here and parent starts here, and the child can only come so far, right? In certain scenarios, parents then have to meet the child from the other direction. And I think transitioning to the parent training really is so helpful in scenarios like that. So yeah, thanks for talking about CPRT because I learned that from you. So there we go. Okay. So let's kind of do a combination question here. So I'm curious, if you feel that I know when you were in Florida, you worked with the homeless population. I remember you working at Metropolitan Ministries. Yes. So I know that that was one population I'm aware of, but do you have any specific populations with whom you've worked in your career? And specifically maybe with natural disasters, I'm aware of your work after the tsunami, and I know you've probably done some other things since. So what have you noticed as far as outcomes? Because let me give you the backstory on why I'm curious about us discussing this, because we're always looking for evidence-based practice, right? We're always looking for the proof of efficacy with an approach. And so there are a lot of really helpful meta-analyses that have been conducted. Yes. You've been a part of those. D. Ray has done them. So we know, practically speaking, we can find journal articles that talk about the efficacy with all types of diagnoses, all types of symptoms, all types of races and backgrounds. So specifically though, I'm curious, what has your experience been, practically speaking, when you work with different populations, and what have those outcomes been?
Yes, yes. Well, speaking of disaster mental health, yes, I began working in disaster mental health actually when I got to Florida, because there were so many hurricanes and there was such an opportunity. But it was interesting in when you talk about the research and the evidence base, I found it to be, despite my trying, very difficult to do research after disaster mental health because of the IRB process took so long to try to get the IRB process through. And
sorry to interrupt you, but for the new people of the field, can you explain IRB?
Institutional Review Board, where it allows you to have permission to do research studies. And that's different than giving your informed consent. You can give an informed consent in, you know, a matter of minutes, but to go through the Institutional Review Board IRB process, it's very long, lengthy. And usually by the time it's done, you know, your window of opportunity is missed. But actually one of the most recent disaster mental health play therapy responses we've done was in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. And so that was really fascinating, where I trained some Spanish speaking play therapists in how to do disaster response play therapy, which I've illustrated in some videos and in journal articles and such. And so we worked with them, and, you know, that was a very, very powerful outcome, I believe, going to the place and working with the parents and the teachers that are there, and then providing some disaster response play therapy. And I think the one thing that really stands out for a lot of that is just that the people feeling that they are that they are honored, that they are recognized, that their pain is worthy in a sense to be healed. And so in that particular time in Puerto Rico, is I don't know if you remember, but there was a lot of, I guess, some political things going on. And so one of the things that I found to be very helpful in disaster response play therapy, and even with different populations of play therapy, is going in with that cultural humility. And going in with some cultural responsiveness, beginning with the cultural humility, trying to be a learner, trying to honor their perspective. And so after her came Maria, there was a real sense of the people that that they had been kind of slighted, that they had been just kind of thrown some paper towels, and here's some paper towels that was being thrown by some political figures. And they felt like, but you're not, people are not giving us what we need. Mm-hmm. And so when we were there, there was that real sense of being able to meet the very personal mental health needs. And we trained some local mental health professionals in play therapy, and then we provided direct play therapy. It was very powerful because there, with the cultural humility, we could understand that there was such a pride in their culture, in the Puerto Rican culture. The play therapy with the children and even with the adolescents that we were working with brought that forward and allowed them to do that. And even in one of my articles I did on Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, I gave the example of working with the children, adolescents. We kind of set up little stations. So we set up some child-centered play therapy stations, some sand tray stations, and then music therapy stations for older kids. And like this one young adolescent girl, we were doing some music therapy with her. And we asked her, can you think of a song that kind of represents what you're doing? Now, this is not part of child-centered play therapy, but I'm just saying this as more of an illustration of honoring people's background and their cultural needs. And so this young girl, she said, yeah, she really liked that song. It's called Scars to Your Beautiful by, I think it's Alicia Cara. And and we asked her, you know, what lyrics do you like? And she said, well, the lyrics she liked was, but there's hope that's waiting for you in the dark. Mm-hmm. That part was so representative because, as you might remember, after Hurricane Maria, Puerto Rico lost power for like weeks.
And water. And
water. And so there was that dark. And she said, but there's hope for you waiting in the dark. You should know you're beautiful just the way you are. And you don't have to change a thing. The world could change. It's hard. No scars to your beautiful. You're stars and we're beautiful. And that it was such a powerful thing because this young lady was saying that's how she sees Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico's been in the dark and we're beautiful just the way we are. We don't have to change. Where this is our culture, we honor our culture. And she was saying, you know, Puerto Rico is beautiful. And she was, as a young Puerto Rican lady, I am beautiful. I don't need to change who I am. And I felt like that was also such a good representation of even child-centered play therapy that we were doing actually in the same room with all these kids that we were working with. You know, kids just kind of like being in the dark and they're wanting someone to honor them, their developmental needs, their needs to process the trauma that they've been through and to recognize that they're beautiful and to give them that opportunity to show that they're beautiful, focusing on the beauty, not the scars, but the beauty of it. And those are some things that really stand out to me about working in disaster mental health and disaster response play therapy, giving folks that opportunity to do that.
Yeah. And I mean, as soon as you said that last line, it just reminded me of the CPRT rule of thumb, focus on the donut, not the hole, right? Because there's so much in the way of let's fix this, let's work on this, this is broken, this is bad, this is what we need to amend, this is how, whatever. And the reality is sometimes the frame shift, right, is to say, but what we have is good. And what's already present is good. And we're going to celebrate what is here. Mm-hmm. And you know, in the midst of disaster, in the midst of difficulty, it's easy to focus on all of the things that are missing. But the reality is sometimes it's more important for kids specifically, but for all of us, right? Mm-hmm. To say, but what's here is really good. And we're going to celebrate and be proud of those things.
Yes.
Yeah. So I love that.
Yeah.
All right. So let's wrap up with a final question. I'm curious what your thoughts are. What advice would you have for new child-centered play therapists? So either newly graduated, very young in age. So this may be their first entrance into the field, or I actually have a lot of clinicians reaching out to me. They've had a completely separate career and in their 40s or 50s discovered child-centered play therapy. And they're like, how have I not done this my whole life? So now later in life, they're actually new to the field, even though they've had a career in a different arena. So what are your best thoughts or tips or advice for them?
Yes. Well, absolutely. Number one, get supervision of reviewing your videos. I supervise, and I've seen so many people, if you will do the work of getting the permission to record your play therapy sessions and then bring them every week and go through it with your child-centered play therapy supervisor, that's when people really can get solid, you know, and
we agree.
Yes. And it's just,
and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I hated it when you did that to me. Yeah. I hated sitting in that lab. I hated watching videos on the old VHS tapes.
Yes.
It's funny, the training that I do right now, the year-long training, I watch the same process every time it starts. I'm like, you're going to be submitting videos and we're going to watch them together. And they're like, no. And it's awkward and it's uncomfortable, but the transformation, I mean, we talk about the transformation kids have in the playroom, right? The transformation, clinically speaking, that happens when you have someone that can watch your videos and in real time say, okay, right there, that was an effective use of this. Okay, that was a missed opportunity. Okay, what's going on thematically here? There is nothing like that.
That's
for
right.
Therapists to have someone that can point out the wins and the opportunities for growth simultaneously. It just makes you so much more aware. You can't get it in any other way. I really don't.
Right. Yeah. Because when people just try to report, oh yeah, this happened in the session, this happened in the session, they don't know what they don't know. So they're not aware that they missed maybe an eye roll of the child or the, you know, little short facial expressions of the child. And so it's just so powerful when you can have the supervision with the videos. And right. Then I would also say go to trainings if you're learning child-centered play therapy, first, just only go to trainings on child-centered play therapy. Otherwise, people get confused too quickly. And then they go, and there are many other wonderful play therapy approaches, but then they get confused. Prescriptive play therapy does it this way, but Adlerian does it this way, but Jungian does it this way, but cognitive behavioral does it this way. And then they just get all confused. So I would say when you're starting off, just go to child-centered play therapy trainings. It could be on particular problems, like if it's divorce or foster children or sexual abuse, on different things, and then maybe different populations of like Latinx or African American or, you know, Puerto Rican, Asian, and so just focus on that. Then later you can spread out after you've got, you know, that really solid foundation of trainings. And then the other thing is, I would say do a lot of reading, specifically again in child-centered play therapy, of journal articles, of books. We have a book I've just been working on that's coming out in is called Contemporary Case Studies and for Clinical Mental Health of Children and Adolescents. And it has several chapters in there on child-centered play therapy with different issues like divorce and African-American, biracial, and adjustment difficulties, all that. So do the reading of in-depth case studies. I think that's very helpful. and do the training and get that supervision. And then finally, just enjoy the journey. You know, it's fun. You'll make progress over the years. And
it is fun. I mean, I think you mentioned that earlier, why you love child-centered play therapy. I think, you know, I joke all the time, I'm never going to have an existential crisis about is what I'm doing what I should be doing. You know, you have like CPAs or hairdressers or whatever, they hit a certain age and they're like, is this really all my life is about? And they like completely uproot their lives and they change their careers and whatever. And I joke all the time, I love what I do. I love my job. I love my career. I love the model. I love working with kids. I never question if what I do matters. I mean, I think there is nothing better than watching kids go from hurt and sad and angry and broken and struggling to thriving and happy and healthy. I mean, I don't know what you could do that's more rewarding than that, and have fun while you do it. So it's just kind of like you get that on top of it.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you so much for your time.
I'm so excited
to have had this hour with you, and thank you for your wisdom and your knowledge and sharing everything that has been part of a very long and distinguished career for you. So, and you know how very much I appreciate you from my career path, because you were the reason it all began. So
we're just so proud of you and everything that you've accomplished, and just sharing, you know, you're like Johnny Appleseed, putting out the seeds throughout the United States and even the world. So thank you so much for what you do. So,
yeah. We're going to grow a whole bunch of really solid child-centered play therapists, hopefully. Yeah, so thank you so much. It was so great to be with you.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
Thank you for listening to the Play Therapy Podcast with Dr. Brenna Hicks. For more episodes and resources, please go to www.playtherapypodcast.com.